You know, I'm not sure what drives people into religion, but I know it drives them out of it. Being somebody who has gone to a few different kinds of church, clergy used to be trained. They used to have a degree. And today, they're charismatic leaders on the whole with a miraculous conversion story. You know, I myself have been to churches that look like nightclubs. I think the overly hip, overly entertainment-oriented, we're going to make a Hollywood church isn't effective.
On this edition of the White Horse Inn, we're concluding our series on questions of faith.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. We are continuing our engagement with the on-the-street interviews that Shane Rosenthal, our producer, conducted at a University of California campus. And doing that, we have our regular panel, Rod Rosenblatt, professor of theology at Concordia University in Irvine, California. Ken Jones is the pastor of Glendale Baptist Church in Miami, Florida. Kim Riddlebarger is the pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim. I'm Mike Horton. I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. We've been listening to some of these questions back and forth on a number of issues: the existence of God, morality and meaning and purpose. In this program, we're focusing particularly on Jesus, the Bible, and the resurrection. So let's go ahead and jump right into it with our first respondent on that particular subject.
In particular, what's your take on Jesus? Do you think he was a nice guy, he was a prophet, or he was God in human flesh?
I think Jesus was a really nice guy. I hesitate to say that I've read the Bible thoroughly, but I've looked through it, so I'm hardly an expert. But everything I've ever read about Jesus was love your fellow man, be nice to other people. And I think even if he wasn't a prophet, he was a hell of a nice philosopher. So I'm generally a fan of Jesus.
It's a hard question. I think if he's not God, then he's someone like Buddha, I guess. Someone who's enlightened.
It's a little amazing that we're now dealing with a generation, not that is losing its grip on the gospel, but has never heard even bad presentations.
Yeah. Well, the idea, that response that if he weren't a great prophet, he's still a really nice guy.
I mean, this has been, the point has been made over and over again throughout history. The most famous version of it, I guess, is C.S. Lewis's Lord Liar Lunatic. And this remains, for all of its simplicity, it's not simplistic. He is either the Lord God, maker of heaven and earth, God incarnate, or he lied, in which case he's not a good man, much less a prophet, or he is a lunatic, in which case he's not enlightened, but benighted by probably some kind of chemical imbalance or some such thing. So one thing you're not allowed in this whole business, if you don't say he is God in the flesh, the one thing you're not allowed to say is that he's a good guy.
Absolutely. You go through the Gospel of John and you find Jesus again and again and again confronting the religious leaders of Israel. By the time you get into John 7 and John 8, as we, in our earlier discussion, there's heated, you whitewashed tomb, you're filled with dead men's bones. Jesus is hardly nice in this contemporary sense of being nice.
Right.
He's telling the truth, and sometimes the truth, when it comes in the form of the law and the gospel, it cuts like a razor, and it then heals. And there are times when Jesus speaks to the religious authorities in Israel and he just shreds them because they're false and faithless shepherds.
Yeah. And the assumption is that Jesus' main message was like the Buddha's main message, like Muhammad's main message, love and peace. Yeah, yeah. And if you would just all give peace a chance.
Niceness
and teaching people to cough in their sleeve. These were the great principles that Jesus taught. All sorts of wonderful things that Jesus taught us that made us better people, kinder.
It's very clear that the two respondents had very little contact with the pages of the New Testament.
Yeah.
And the biggest one of all is that
the failure to recognize that in the New Testament itself, Jesus claimed to be God. And in the Old Testament, it anticipated that the one who would come to save his people from their sins would in fact be no less than God.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus raising his hand, saying, I'm that one, and then being raised on the third day to prove that he was, kind of sets him apart. So you really do come to a fork in the road here where you either have to say he is who he said he was,
mm-hmm.
or he was a fake. But again, this assumption that Jesus just came along to tell people how to help old ladies cross the street more safely just doesn't really
it's not in the New Testament.
Okay, next question.
What are your thoughts about the Bible in particular? Do you think it's fiction? Do you think it's nonfiction?
Personally, I think most of it is fiction. I hate to make people mad, but I don't believe it.
So what's that rooted in? Why do you think that?
Well, first off, I hesitate to trust any book that's been revised that much. There's this nice book I'd recommend called Misquoting Jesus.
Bart Ehrman.
Yeah, where it talks about how, isn't it the most translated book in all of history? I think it's like, it's at least really up there. And they didn't have, you know, printing presses or just nice translators. It was up to the scribe to just say, hey, this sounds like this, but this sounds kind of stupid. I'm going to take this out and I might put this in. And it's really just so up to human error that the English copy that we have today compared to the original works of these people is probably not all that similar. So,
well, first of all, when you start with Bart Ehrman, the author of Misquoting Jesus, you're already in the realm of caricature and trivialization. The comments that were made there, it's difficult to know where to begin with them because they're so off.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, to say the Bible's fiction is different than saying the Bible's not historically accurate. And I wonder if he's confused on that point. Myth would be that these are made up out of whole cloth. Their stories get told over and over and over again and finally take on some sort of religious significance. That takes a long period of time, as C.S. Lewis has correctly shown, generations. And, of course, here we don't have that even on Bart Ehrman's thesis. The young man, basically, having read Ehrman, is convinced that the text of the New Testament has been corrupt. That's far different than saying what's in the text is mythological. So he's confused on that point. The second thing is, you know, Bart Ehrman's thesis has been pretty well shredded by Charles Hill at Reformed Seminary in Orlando. His book on textual criticism has just wiped these guys out. Same with Michael Kruger on their book on canon. I mean, the Ehrman thesis has been pretty well hammered. And
by the way, this work was done at Cambridge and Edinburgh. This is first-class work. Bart Ehrman himself came from a fundamentalist background.
Moody Bible Institute.
Had a very, shall we say, reductionistic view of what the Bible is to begin with.
Well, and the sad thing is to say there's a big market for ex-fundamentalists who can get on the National Geographic Channel or A&E or Discovery or something during Easter season every year and sell a pile of books. I mean, I've been raised in the bookstore industry. I'm a bit cynical about that kind of stuff. But I think the reality is Ehrman's arguments are fatally flawed. His presuppositions are the text isn't accurate. Any difference means that someone is monkeying with the text as opposed to textual variants, and they creep in because scribes are trying to fix what some scribe wrote before. But there are thousands of manuscripts that show what the original reading is, and we can get back to the text of the New Testament within, 99.5% accuracy?
Well, let me say this specifically about the young man and his response. There were a couple things that stood out to me. One, he offered a lot of the general arguments against the reliability of scriptures, and it's evident that he himself had not actually read them. So he just kind of threw some statements out there that he's heard here or there, that the various translations, and he confused revisions and translations. I think that's what he was attempting to do.
Textual criticism, which is getting to the actual historic text,
so
and translating are two different things.
Exactly. But at least, even if he hadn't read the scriptures, at least he had read Ehrman. Probably picked it up because it supported his view, but at least he had something to go along with his argument. The biggest problem there, because a lot of people will just pass on those vague arguments and, how do you know the Bible? Yeah, assertions. How do you know the Bible is reliable? And they'll make rash statements and they won't cite one portion of the scriptures, why he thinks it's fiction and not fact.
Well, this man actually made an argument as to why he didn't believe.
Yes.
And since he made an argument as to why he didn't believe, we would have good common ground on which to engage him and say, absolutely, I think that this is a debate about the facts, and I think you're misinterpreting
that's
the data.
My point.
So at least we've got some good common ground. Yeah, we have a good conversation with this guy.
All right, and how about that book, The Bible? If you were to boil it down to one thing, is it fiction? Is it nonfiction, mythology? What do you take it as now?
Well, it's definitely not complete fiction, because there's truth in it. And it's a good book for telling you what to do. So I just don't trust its claim to be like the one and only book that is the be-all, end-all. It has been translated and retranslated multiple times, and then you have missing books from it. And
so what's it rooted in then? The idea that it's been translated and it's had revisions over the years. How do you know that? What have you studied?
What have I studied?
Mm-hmm.
I learned it in class.
Mm.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, see, first of all, missing books.
It's the Bauer thesis, and that's probably worth spending at least a minute or two on. A German scholar, F.C. Bauer, who argued that there were not orthodoxy in the early church, but orthodoxies. And there were different geographical regions which had different interpretations of the Bible, some of them different books. And to boil the whole story down to the simple distillation, when Constantine becomes the emperor and the church power becomes political, then that political power determines orthodoxy and what books are in the canon. So the idea is that once you have a Christian emperor, that settles the question of canonics, that settles the question of text, that settles the question of whose orthodoxy are we going to accept. And, of course, that's absolutely fallacious, and as we mentioned, Kostenberger and Hill and others have just destroyed that thesis.
Yeah, a really great resource, as Kim mentions here, is Michael Kruger and Andreas Kostenberger. What's the title?
The Heresy of Orthodoxy, How Contemporary Culture's Fascination with Diversity Has Reshaped Our Understanding of Early Christianity. It's a great
book. The Heresy of Orthodoxy.
Yeah, great book.
And it's against that thesis that basically the New Testament is a collection of late documents that were the result of Constantine pushing perfectly mainstream Christians out of the circle for political reasons.
And the other one to look at is Canon Revisited, Establishing the Origins and Authority of the New Testament. That's from Michael Kruger at RTS.
Excellent. Those are great. Both are excellent stellar books. Yep. Let's listen to the next question.
From my understanding of the Catholic religion, the Bible was reiterated by the disciples, so it's based on viewpoints of people, not on the viewpoint of the divine person.
Correct me if I'm wrong, the Quran written 600-ish AD? So it says that Jesus, he only appeared to die on the cross.
Right.
But if that's 600 years later, wouldn't it be better to go with the first century eyewitnesses?
Right, that's a very good point that you brought up, but in our Quran, there's actually a whole chapter about Jesus where it explains all of the miracle or whatever you want to call it about his life and his death. From my understanding, God put someone else in his place, and he was not the person who was on the cross. One of the miracles of God is that the amount of stuff he could do. If he can do something like make a woman pregnant without being touched by a man, he can easily fool someone's eyes into seeing something that maybe they haven't seen or that isn't exactly true, or putting someone in the place that isn't that person.
But what God can do and what God did do are two different questions.
The reason I would say that Muslims don't value the first-hand account as much so is because of the discrepancies that where they place the value on Mary. So if they already place that much high value, I think it discredits them and devalues their sources in other people's eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does discredit Roman Catholicism. But the church has not always held that Mary is a semi-divine figure or co-mediatrix. So there are misunderstandings there. When it comes to discrepancies, are these discrepancies that later editors brought into the New Testament documents?
Well, again, that's...
This is huge, not only among Muslims, but we've heard just about everybody.
Yeah, we've heard a couple of themes so far, and one of them is the collision of how evolution has driven people away from the faith. And the other here is the general distrust of the accuracy and reliability of the New Testament. And here I have a young man who's willing to ignore or evade eyewitness testimony because of his assumption that Muhammad was a prophet. He has no basis upon which to argue Muhammad was a prophet. No, there was nothing that Muhammad did that predictive prophecy or anything that comes remotely close to the Old Testament predicting the coming of Christ who fulfills it. And you have eyewitnesses, and you have the words of Christ himself that tell us what exactly he's doing on the cross. None of that matters because Muhammad's a prophet.
Right. But at least he is being true to the book of faith that he holds.
Exactly.
Which is the
Quran. And quotes yes. it, and that, as he yeah. should. As yeah. he should.
But again, as Shane brought up in the question that he asked, why should an interpretation of the crucifixion written 600 yes. years after exactly. the fact yeah. trump something that we know was written in the first century?
Yeah. And especially written by someone who has an agenda to replace that earlier religion with yeah. his own. I mean, right. that, yeah. that just has to, the motives are very clear here.
We've yeah. got to train, at least beginning with the church, the difference between asserting and arguing for.
Sure.
Big difference. These guys finally are being trained to go after historic Christianity, and the critics have helped them to do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But historically, Islam hasn't a long, great history in apologetics for Islam. Now they've figured, coming into the Western world, they're going to have to do some of this with Christians, and they happen to be coming when the church is at a very low point in training the sheep in even the basics of apologetics. We don't have a homogeneous Europe anymore or a Christendom. That's over. And so it's incumbent on us to begin by saying to assert something is not the same as to offer an argument in behalf of.
Right.
But if nothing else, this is a wake-up call mm-hmm. to zillions of people attending zillions of experientially oriented churches. And you just, it isn't worth your whole afternoon to go learn to hone your experience story better.
Right.
Yeah.
Next question.
Some people argue that the Bible has been mistranslated. It's gone through revisions. What's your take on that debate?
I think so. I think definitely it's been mistranslated. The thing about the Bible is that you can maybe take some ambiguities in there and really just kind of, you know, skew them. That's why we've had some run-ins with religious nuts, you know, that have just taken things to the extremes. And that's, you know, it's kind of just that one person sort of ruining it for everyone. It's just one person saying so many things and using the Bible as their backing to just kind of, you know, ruin the general view of religious people. But I think the Bible as a whole is just, it's a wonderful work, but it can definitely, if it falls into the wrong hands, it can be definitely misread and definitely, you know, demented into something it's not.
Sure.
Sure, we can find nuts that have distorted yeah. scripture all over the place. We can help him find more than he even knows.
Yeah. Yeah. All you can say is, yeah, sure, I
exactly.
agree. But
except his argument that the Bible was mistranslated.
Right.
I mean,
right.
We're back to that.
Critics of earlier centuries were better informed about the content of the Bible than today's young Christians know is in there.
Well, George yeah. Lindbeck at Yale University said that when he first arrived at Yale in the 1950s, those who were raised in agnosticism knew the Bible better than those who now, mm-hmm. he said, in the 90s, were raised in fundamentalist homes.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. He made the classic mistake that we've heard from a couple of these guys in confusing translations, or he's making assumptions about the process.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe even interpretations.
And interpretations.
Give him the yeah. benefit of the doubt. He may have been thinking bad yeah. interpretations.
Because the bulk of his answer was the mishandling mm-hmm. of yes. the scriptures.
Right. It's important yes. that people hear us too. We're not reactionary here. We're not angry or upset that someone accuses the Bible of being mistranslated. Mm-hmm. That's a legitimate, if you really have that kind of claim, we want to hear your evidence.
Sure. Exactly.
The reason we're disagreeing with it is because it has absolutely no credibility whatsoever as a scholarly thesis.
Exactly. And there again, if what you're saying you believe is true, would you mind giving me an example of it and where you got it, or whether that's firsthand, maybe it is with you, maybe you chased it down, but at least enter into the realm of the university. That's mm-hmm. what, you know, that's why we're talking to you, is because you're attending a university, and can you apply the same sort of a rigor that you've had to do in your classes to what you're doing here.
But to assert
yes.
mistranslation without even really, I mean, one of the earlier commentators mentioned that it has gone through so many mistranslations because perhaps he's thinking about scribal errors. Or,
right.
Well, there are a whole bunch of categories here you have to keep distinct. One is textual criticism, which is the science of getting back to the original text. That's one issue. We have the original text.
What about, is the original text?
Right. We have it at about 99.5% accuracy. That's number one. Number two is translation. Can you translate Koine Greek into modern English? Yes, you can, very accurately. The ESV, the New American Standard are really good illustrations of somebody accurately translating Koine Greek or Hebrew into modern English. That's another issue. The third issue is interpretation. Mm-hmm. What do you do with it when you have an accurate text and then translate it? Are there people who are kooks and who read the Bible and find all kinds of bizarre things and don't know how to make sense of the context of the way in which the testaments relate to each other? Yes, and there are a lot of them, and we can help find them if they're looking for them, because we would like to identify them as well as these people would. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of this is an excuse. Mm-hmm. These are college-age kids. They're away from home. They want to do what they want to do. They don't want any external authority reining them in.
It could be that that's exactly the sort of Oprah motives that are in there. And with college students, it's hard to doubt it. But there are many classes in which what they're already wondering and thinking about wondering about is aided by the professor in the front of the room.
Sure.
And it's very easy, we all know, as students, to sort of be parasitic on the secondary source, an authority figure, certainly, up in the front of the room in a college classroom. Mm-hmm. The fact that the guy is up there in his discipline, as you guys have said earlier, doesn't make him an expert in the discipline we happen to inhabit. But the student is having to pay his tuition money to endure that.
Think of it this way. There have been really brilliant scientists down through the ages who held views that are less enlightened than a view that a common, average, everyday person with a high school diploma readily possesses today. It's not the amount of education that you've had or the expertise that you have on that topic that makes you correct. Mm-hmm. That expertise only means that you've had the time and the opportunity to study something for a long time, but you could study it and confirm your error, your erroneous conclusion, over many years. And a person who really hasn't studied it for that long or in that great a depth may still, in fact, be right, be correct in his conclusion. The point is, everybody knows this as a fallacy. The appeal to authority is a fallacy. When you are basing what you believe on the majority opinion of the people around you or the expertise of the people around you, rather than in the appropriateness of the conclusions themselves, you're basically handing your mind over to something that you haven't tested yourself, the very thing that you think religionists are doing when they trust the Bible.
Okay, how would you respond? I'm going to play advocate here. How would you respond to the charge that you're appealing to authority when you cite Scripture?
I am appealing to authority. The question, though, is whether I can make arguments for it.
Right.
And in particular, we want to train people to do this inductively, not deductively. Start with just Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as history. And if you found that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were good historians, you could start working with what's the plot line, who's the major character, what did he say about himself, and so forth. And if you end up with a divine Christ, he gives you, in a way that you never would have guessed ahead of time, a high view of the Old Testament. If he was God incarnate and it's knowable by his resurrection from the dead, then his view of the Old Testament probably is the one you should opt for. Now, that's to do it inductively.
So you're taking Jesus' view of Scripture.
Because
From the
historical narrative, it looks like I should.
Let's go to the next question.
Christians make the claim that he rose again from the dead. That's part of the essence of classical Christian orthodoxy. It's what Easter's all about.
Symbol of his...
If you don't believe he rose from the dead, what do you think did happen?
I don't think that he rose from the dead because, again, the whole miracle thing that we were talking about. But I think that there are any number of possibilities that could have happened. And I'm not pretending to be an expert on what happened. I don't, it's not like I've, you know, researched it or anything. But to me, it's just, it'd be pretty easily explainable by any number of circumstances, I think. What's more likely, either a really clandestine operation where it's just they move the body out and everything, or that he rose from the dead?
So after he was crucified, then what happened to cause the growth of Christianity? So were they lying, or did they see a hallucination? Or so what's your explanation?
They could possibly be lying about it.
Yeah, of course they could possibly could be lying. So you have to look at the facts of the case. And to his credit, he said he hadn't. I mean, at least he said that. Let's look at the facts of the case here. First of all, Jesus lived, died, and was buried. There aren't liberals.
Right. Everybody agrees on that.
Everybody agrees on that.
And everything that you just said can be proved outside of the scriptures.
Well, for example, even Marcus Borg, co-founder of the Radical Jesus Seminar, concedes that Christ's death by Roman crucifixion is, quote, the most certain fact about the historical Jesus. Or, this is from Joseph Klausner's summary of the Babylonian Talmud, Yeshua was a false prophet hanged on Passover Eve for sorcery and blasphemy. He was a rabbi whose mother, Mary, was married to a carpenter who was nevertheless not the natural father of Jesus. Jesus went with his family to Egypt, returned to Judea, and made disciples, performed miraculous signs by the devil, led Israel astray, and was deserted at his trial without any defenders. On Passover Eve, he was crucified. That's everything but the front end and the back end of the Apostles' Creed.
From those who did not agree and denied it.
Late in the first century, Tacitus, the great Roman historian, referred to the crucifixion of Jesus under Pontius Pilate. Romans and Jews acknowledged he was crucified. They even agreed that the tomb was empty, and we know that because they argued that the disciples stole the body. At least the Jews argued that the disciples stole the body. The Romans didn't because, of course, that would have been a very bad thing to say.
Crime against interest, right?
Yeah, you know these cowardly men and a few women? Yeah, they kind of stole the body that had a Roman imperial seal over it with the police guarding it.
Why would the Romans steal the body anyway? They wanted to stop Christianity, not start it. That makes no sense whatsoever.
Produce a body, and you've just ended Christianity.
How are 12 fishermen and disciples of crude origin keep this secret that they've stolen the body of Jesus without it ever being discovered? It just makes no sense. Add to that the fact that the cost for keeping that conspiracy was to be killed.
Yes.
Right. Matthew 28 tells us that many of the Jewish people immediately after the resurrection said that it was the disciples who stole the body. And Romans were concerned about the disruption caused over Jesus' tomb. There's the Edict of Caesar known as the Nazareth Inscription, dated to around 41 AD, where evidently there was some problem with a grave robbery. It's called the Nazareth Inscription, and capital punishment was to be imposed on anyone who stole a body. I mean, that's the only explanation they had. Of course, Rome and the Jewish leaders were not going to say he had been raised from the dead. So what's the least embarrassing of a bad situation?
Produce a body and the whole thing's over before it starts.
That's right.
Yeah.
In a letter to the Emperor Trajan around 110, Pliny the Younger, imperial governor of what's now Turkey, reported that Christians gathered on Sunday regularly to pray to Jesus, quote, as to a god, to hear the letters of his appointed officers read and expounded, and to receive a meal at which they believed Christ himself presided.
Wow.
So now, the friend there said, you know, what is easier to believe? Well, is it easy actually to believe that the disciples stole the body when it was guarded by a Roman guard and a Jewish guard? First of all, ask yourself this question. Why on earth, especially if you represent yourself and your comrades in the texts that will become the foundation for your religion, represent yourself as a coward, so you don't even get any credit for standing with him there, and you're willing to die? There are plenty of people who are willing to lie for a particular doctrine that will benefit them financially or in other ways. These folks are not going to benefit at all. In fact, they're going to face certain martyrdom. They know this. This is not a surprise to them. And only after his resurrection did these people who showed themselves to be cowards become willing martyrs.
Right.
Who does that? That if I was part of a conspiracy to steal a body in order to invent a religion, I wouldn't take it so far as to actually get myself killed for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think at the end of the day, the young man's question, which is easier to believe, that there were shenanigans going on or the body was raised, it is easier to believe the shenanigans were going on. I mean, I'm with him on that. The question is, mm-hmm. what does the evidence say?
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you start weighing the evidence, what likely
Great
happened?
Point.
What likely happened is the tomb was empty. That is far and away the best explanation. It's the one I like the least, but it's the one that the evidence drives me to that point.
Yeah.
And again, he began by saying, well, given what I've said about miracles, therefore.
Great point.
Yeah.
Great
yeah.
point.
Yeah.
Whereas we would say, yeah, you're exactly right. If you start with there are no miracles, therefore there can't be a resurrection, guess what you're going to end up at?
Yeah, they faked it.
But what we're saying is don't start with yes or no to miracles.
Right.
Start with the resurrection. And if the resurrection happened, just the possibility of miracles.
Yeah, you might after that say virtually all dead people stay dead.
Yes. 99.9
except for
99.99.
Right. Okay, our next question.
You know, I'm not sure what drives people into religion, but I know it drives them out of it. I have a lot of experience with a fairly radical evangelical church. And sadly, a lot of these radical evangelical movements are becoming considered more and more mainstream Christianity, even though they're not traditionally. And I find that there's two kinds of people. There are people that go to church seeking some sort of, they have some question that they want answered. And it might be a sort of they need therapy. Mm-hmm. And it might be they just have an existential question that they think a church can answer because they've tried other forms of thought that have failed to answer them. But there are people also that are just born into it. And people that are born into a Pentecostal denomination, you tend to think that that's the right way. And you tend to be skeptical of, say, the Episcopalians. The Episcopalians are doing something wrong, or, you know, the Mormons are doing something wrong. And so a lot of it does really have to do with, you know, what did you hear first? How strong was it? How strict was it? And how long were you in it? Which isn't really furthering free thought or, you know, reasonable argument, reasoning out, do I have a belief in God? And I do find that there are more and more people, especially my age and younger, there is this generation that usually has departed from the God of their fathers, so to speak, but not to radical atheism, not to just, you know, say screw you and we're done in a rebellious sort of fashion, but to take a few steps back and say, you know what, I've learned this stuff at church and I've learned this stuff at school or through science, and both seem like a little bit of it's right, and both there are, you know, questions that I have about other arguments, and trying to reason out rationally their own path. Being somebody who has gone to a few different kinds of church, and just seen a lot of them feel a lot like boys clubs. Being a feminist, I'm completely against that. And a lot of them, they have this pseudo-elitism. Right now, there's a lot of evangelical churches that have a grotesque hatred for the intelligentsia. And I haven't had my first master's degree from the University of Oxford in England. It's just funny because you hear all this degree bashing and the academics do this and the academics do that. And I think what they fail to realize, because they don't talk to any academics, they don't talk to the academic theologians, they don't talk to the academics that have deep beliefs in God, for instance. Clergy used to be trained. They used to have a degree, you know, from a seminary. I mean, Princeton was a great one for many, many years. And so you did have a lot of the movers and shakers of and thinkers of theology that were from very, very good institutions. And today, they're charismatic leaders on the whole with a miraculous conversion story. And that is a very different social trend.
Wow.
I don't know what to say except agree with everything
One thing she said early on that I think is so important, and then in that last statement she fleshes it out, she talked about her church background from this radical evangelical movement, yep. and she identified it as being a departure
yes.
from historic Christianity.
Yes.
And the latter part of what she had to say fleshes that out.
Yep.
I don't know how deeply she understands these issues, but just from what she said, she's not just... This is not a knee-jerk response.
No, no.
This is rooted in history. She has a better understanding of
yeah.
the theological trends than
she
many.
She knows the history of that independent sect yes. is yeah. better than they do, unfortunately.
Yeah. As critical as we can be of a lot of evangelical sects, it's very anti-intellectual and so forth, we still have to, I think, recognize that among evangelicals— You have some of the leading theologians, biblical scholars, Old Testament, New
sure.
Testament scholars. There is this kind of, I think people could be in a movement that is very insular, and it's basically, do you listen to Pastor so-and-so? But that's not representative of the whole of evangelicalism.
No, right. It's not. Reading between the lines from a couple of things she said, one thing she identified herself as a feminist mm-hmm. and probably is up against a patriarchal structure that, mm-hmm. you know, and she now has issues with that given
sure.
cultural things.
Sure.
I wouldn't at all be surprised if gay marriage wasn't a real big issue for her. I know demographically that mm-hmm. category, we've lost that argument mm-hmm. with the under 30-something crowd. And so she sees herself as standing outside that particular church on morality mm-hmm. and holding to different ethical positions than they do, not really getting any answers from her except probably Bible verses quoted back at her.
Right.
And as she identified at the end, she said, these are charismatic leaders with no mm. substance, but they have miraculous conversion stories.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
So they're able to give big testimonies, but there's a big hat and no cattle.
And have great drawing power.
Yeah, and so, yeah, so she's come up against...
In contrast with an earlier generation of educated yes. clergy yes. from, say, Princeton.
And she's yeah. come up against the changing social mores. She's gone with them, and they apparently haven't had much ammunition to use against her.
Very interesting. Let's hear one more comment from her.
There was a Rolling Stones article sometime last year where it was a gentleman who wrote this article, and he went into an evangelical church that had a lot. It was a kind of a big box church that had a lot of the, you know, evangelical entertainment sort of thing. And there was a specific guitarist singer that he saw, very metrosexual, this low cut, tight V-neck shirt, and that he was singing about Jesus while he was arching his back in a very sexually suggestive posture. And the, you know, and this is a Rolling Stones writer, so you imagine kind of where he went with that. But he was very struck by this, that not only was it, you know, an entertainment induced thing, it wasn't just entertainment, but there was like a pornographic element to it. And so he had a great criticism on how that's not what he expected at church. You know, I myself have been into churches that look like nightclubs, and there's nothing wrong with a nightclub, but there's something, number one, really pretentious about a church trying to pretend it's a nightclub. And when you see the audience and they're typically middle-aged and older women and older men, and, you know, they're dressed to the nines and they're going to church, and there's sort of like a barbed wire cage around the drum. I've actually seen that. There's a place in Riverside that's like that. And you expect there to be a stripper's pole. And I think it's giving the wrong message. I think the overly hip, overly entertainment-oriented, we're going to make a Hollywood church, isn't effective.
Oh, just let her.
Wow. We need to have her as a guest.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Nothing really to
no.
just let her talk.
Yeah.
Folks, just once again, we just have to make the point that if there are any pastors out there, youth pastors, parents, teachers, if there's anybody out there who still thinks that we're losing folks because we're not dumbing it down enough or because we're not entertaining enough, seriously? I mean, just listen to these people. One person after another has basically said if they did come from a Christian background, they weren't taught anything. There was nothing to keep them there. They didn't want candy to be thrown at them. That's all they got. And their church looked like a nightclub.
Charismatic leaders with great testimonies.
Yeah.
The evangelical celebrity circuit.
Yeah. So now here we are with people reading Rolling Stone to us in on-the-street interviews. The culture holding up a mirror to us and saying, wow, you know, You're not even a formidable foe anymore.
Yeah, we expected better of you.
Yeah.
Jesus said, the world will hate you because it hates me. The world doesn't hate us now. The world just kind of now looks at us and says, wow, you're not even a worthy opponent anymore.
Yes.
Right.
Folks, you know, the Apostle Paul didn't say, if Jesus isn't raised, even if he's not, haven't you lived a better life? You ask me how I know he lives within my heart. No, Paul says, if he's not raised, then let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. We're living in an age, folks, when religion is just generally speaking in the category of the irrational. And I understand that. I do think most of religion is in the category of the irrational. But the Christian faith is different. It's so different that even a Jewish scholar like Pinchas Lapid in the 1980s could write a book called The Resurrection of Jesus, A Jewish Perspective, and challenge liberal theologians with this. I cannot rid myself of the impression that some modern Christian theologians are ashamed of the material facticity of the resurrection. Their varying attempts at dehistoricizing Easter, which give the lie to all four evangelists, are simply not understandable to me in any other way. Indeed, the four authors of the Gospels definitely compete with one another in illustrating the tangible, substantial dimensions of this historical resurrection explicitly. One has to read Gentile philosophical categories into Jewish texts like these Gospels in order to make them say what liberals require. But for the first Christians, who thought, believed, and hoped in a Jewish manner, the immediate historicity was not only a part of that happening, but the indispensable precondition for the recognition of its significance for salvation, end quote. Folks, this is not an irrational act of the will. This is not an irrational subjective leap. This is a story that is true, and we know it is true because God has given proof of this by raising Jesus from the dead. And so that we have great confidence every Lord's Day to announce to the world, to be comforted ourselves, that it's not because of our need for inner comfort that we find this story useful. It's comforting because it's actually true. We look forward to being with you again next time on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.